Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Come on,
Jack.
Let's go.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody, for Super Bowl Sunday edition of Midrats. I am Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with the ever-genial co-host Eagle One from the blog Eagle Speak. For a reminder of those that aren't totally immersed in their third pitcher of beer for Saturday, Super Bowl Sunday. Make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the show page. We're trying to get some of the usual suspects together. Share your observations or questions as we go forward, and we'll try to fold that right into the show. And as always, if you're new to Midrats or you want to catch up on some of the shows you missed, you can always get the archives at Blog Talk Radio or set yourself up to get the podcast on iTunes. And let's pop right into the show. And this week's guest for the whole hour is going to be Nathan Hughes. He is a director of military awareness at Strat4, a global intelligence company. Just a little bit on his background. He has a uniform background. He was a mortarman with the 1st Marine Division, at which he deployed to the 11th Marine Expeditionary Unit in 2002, and also with RCT-1 in Iraq in 2003. In his civilian role, he also embedded briefly with the Marines in Afghanistan. He has a few awards under his belt as he gets to be a writer. He was the third-place winner in the annual Proceedings Robotics Essay Contest in 2010. And he's also been a contributor to the Marine Corps Gazette and National Defense. Nate, welcome to Midrats.
Hey, thanks. It's an honor to be here.
Great. When a lot of our listeners may be just vaguely familiar with Strat4, they've seen them referenced, or that somebody has emailed an article that Strat4 has put out. If you could, for a second, tell everybody what Strat4 is, what your role is, and how your business model works.
Mm. Well, we were founded about 15 years ago by Dr. George Friedman with the idea that the way the world was becoming connected, the IT revolution, everything that's changed our lives so much in the last two decades, had reached the point where you no longer needed the resources and budget of a national intelligence apparatus to carry out an intelligence function. So when we talk about being a global intelligence company, it's not really a marketing scheme so much as the way we approach information. We use that sort of intelligence paradigm rather than, say, a journalistic one. We're really trying to look forward and craft perceptions, so rather than cranking out, you know, individual isolated articles on things, we sort of have a narrative and a coherency to what we're talking about. We're always pushing forward, trying to figure out where things are going rather than just describing what has happened. So we have forecasts that we stand by and net assessments and all the things that would be sort of familiar to anyone in the intelligence trade. And one of the really fascinating things working there is that it's a smaller entity, and so there's a lot of opportunity for cross-disciplinary discussion. We're really all required to be involved in our assessments, all of our products, and so the military side, for example, I don't get to just geek out about games and stuff all the time. I basically am required to, and part of the process is working with our other analysts, our political analysts, our economic analysts, and really crafting a sort of coherent, integrated perspective on things. And I get to work with some really smart people doing that, but it also forces you to take a new perspective on relevancy, to what you're talking about. You know, does this really matter? Is this really a driving political force? And so when we do in our China coverage or in our Egypt coverage, for example, I help the other analysts make sure that what they're doing is grounded in military realities, and they help me when we do our assessments have not just the technical military perspective, but also the political context, the economic considerations that all come into that. And so that's sort of a snapshot of what we do. Egypt has obviously been great for business. But yeah, with that, I think that's a good quick update.
I think I would be a little remiss, and you mentioned Egypt. It's obviously it's been the big story this week. You know, week before that it was Tunisia, but Egypt is obviously a much more important issue to discuss for a variety of reasons. And one thing I think has been unfortunate recently is if you're trying to get information on Egypt recently, it's maddeningly American focused. For instance, Ambassador Wisner went over to Egypt as the envoy. He came back. He stated that Mubarak is important as a transitional figure. And within a short period of time, the administration came out and said he's just speaking for himself. And before we knew it, that he's been totally relieved of his duties. We saw Senator Kerry today come on and speaking as if he was the Secretary of State. Of course, Secretary of State Clinton's come out. But the discussion has all been our internal criminology inside the U.S. There hasn't really been a discussion about what is really happening in Egypt and what are those latest developments are. Looking at it from your perspective, what are some of the top two or three issues you see are going to help drive this challenge in Egypt, either down the Iranian template format, the status quo, or perhaps something that we would find pleasantly surprising?
Well, I think the heart of the question is really not what happens to Mubarak, but what happens to the regime. At this point, it's pretty clear that one way or another, Mubarak's going to go. But what we've really got is a question about the government and the regime that is probably the single most underappreciated American ally in the world today. Egypt has been a huge ally in terms of intelligence sharing in the global war on terror. But it's also, for 30 years, it's been, its stability, its peace through the peace treaty with Israel has been a linchpin of how the U.S. Manages the Middle East. And so when we have these conversations about democracy, you lose that geopolitical importance sometimes. And the fact that I think the single most important question we need to be asking is, can Cairo, as we have known it for the last 30 years, continue to exist? Now, there can be some limited reforms, or there can be great reforms. That's really one question. But we've also had I don't have the exact individual in front of me, but somebody mentioned at some point the idea someone associated with the Muslim Brotherhood mentioned at some point that the peace treaty with Egypt or with Israel should be put to a referendum at some point. Now, obviously, that has fairly enormous potential consequences. The opposition is sort of so the two key two key entities here are the regime as it exists, and we've got a lot of people with a lot of personal wealth associated with the regime, a lot of influence. People's careers, if not lives, are being discussed. So there's going to be maneuvering, and it may actually serve the military purpose, for example, to keep Mubarak in place as sort of a magnet for all the things he's now a magnet for in terms of dissent and international outrage, while at the same time they're cleaning house internally. But the question is that what is going to be necessary to placate the masses, the opposition? The demonstrators are not going to be happy if Mubarak steps aside in September, only to be replaced by another officer who is pretty much a strongman running the country. So whether that's going to be manageable remains to be seen. Now, the opposition isn't exactly well organized. The Muslim Brotherhood has been systematically repressed for a generation. And you've got all these youth protests rising up. Some of the initial representatives of the youth movement spoke to the vice president. And then all of a sudden you have these groups in the streets saying, no, these guys don't represent us. They don't speak for us. Not that these guys necessarily reported to, but you see this mass headless opposition, and you've got a couple guys like Alberde attempting to maneuver there. But it's really not clear how unified these guys can get, because the only thing that really unifies them is their opposition to Mubarak. And so it's not a foregone conclusion that once Mubarak goes away, that all this stuff is going to come crumbling down. I mean, you got to remember, Alberde is spent a lot of time in the West, very secular, which doesn't necessarily resonate with the young masses of Egypt. So you've got a lot of different undercurrents that have been sort of repressed and managed for decades by the regime. And once that all breaks loose, just what it's going to take to get it all back in order or integrated into some sort of more representative political process, it's going to be a very interesting couple weeks ahead and months ahead.
Let me ask kind of an odd question, I think, but I was just making a list of trouble spots or areas that we might have some concerns around the world. Venezuela, Afghanistan, Egypt, Somali pirates, Mexico, Pakistan. And we used to have a saying in this country that politics end at the U.S. shore. And it was, there was going to be a united front on our positions with respect to other countries. Are we at the point where short-term interests have overwhelmed our strategic thinking about some of these foreign areas, and we're kind of in the reactive mode when an event like Egypt comes up? Do we have a long-term strategy that you're aware of that how we should be addressing this, or is the action of the administration where we seem to be sticking the toe in and getting it wet and then withdrawing the toe and trying a different foot? Is that just kind of the way things are going nowadays?
I asked that exact same question a little while. One of my first entries over to the U.S. Naval Institute's blog, where I also do a bit of writing, it was pretty much first question: have tactical operational needs sort of subsumed larger grand strategy and larger strategic thinking? And I think it's the right question to be asking. Our founder, Dr. Friedman, just released a new book called The Next Decade. And one of the questions that this book looks at is, do we have a government that's capable of thinking strategically? And we certainly have. I'm reading a pretty fascinating book on the history of War Plan Orange right now, and he has some clear-headed, sustained thinking grounded in geopolitics and sort of the underlying realities of the dynamics in the Pacific. But what we've got now is we've got this enormous government apparatus. It was pretty much built and designed to fight World War II with the management, organization, and IT infrastructure of the 1940s. And I don't think anybody doubts that the U.S. government is not as agile as it needs to be for the 21st century. But I think there's something – I think you're getting at a far more fundamental issue, which is if we have a problem in front of us, we have an enormous wealth of national resources that we can bring to bear on it. Now, some aspects of the government are better able to bring things to bear, especially overseas, military and state, than others. But the thing is, look at Iraq, look at Afghanistan, look at how much treasure and manpower and attention we've been able to put into those immediate pressing problems. But the question I asked in that blog entry is the exact one you're asking. It's not – we can get into Afghanistan probably in a little bit if we want to, but not questioning whether the search was the right choice, not questioning how we got from A to B, but just saying – If you take sort of a decade perspective, take a step back, a little bit higher altitude, and you know we've got 100,000 U.S. troops and almost 50,000 allied troops in Afghanistan. We're going to be spending this year the entire Afghan gross domestic product in 2008, just the U.S. alone to train and equip the Afghan security forces, which are going to cost far more than the government makes just to sustain. And we're doing this fundamentally to fight a transnational terrorist threat. There's something not right there in terms of strategy, in terms of grand strategy, and in terms of the amount of resources we're allocating to this problem, and also the immense opportunity costs of the things we're not doing. So there's, I think there's two things there. There's the allocation of disproportionate force and resources to a problem, and it's also a sort of how do you say this? It's a inappropriate use of those resources, in that if you're a transnational terrorist entity, if you're dealing with a transnational extremist phenomena ideology, where's the one place they're not going to be? The place where you have 100,000 troops. Now, they are in Pakistan, they are across the border, but you've got Yemen, the Maghreb, Southeast Asia. And this was never a existential threat to the United States. I think we've done a pretty phenomenal job in counterterrorism in the last decade, because we haven't had another major attack, certainly nothing since the attacks in London and Madrid. But we've lost sight of some grand strategic thinking in terms of managing the rise of China, managing the resurgence of Russia. And that's the real question. And what Dr. Friedman gets to in his book is that's probably the real danger to the Republic. Potential that we aren't able to behave in a coherent, forward-thinking, and long-range manner in terms of the coherent crafting of and management of national grand strategy.
You know, I think you know, on a larger issue, I mean, you bring up a very good point nationally, but I think we saw something else, and it's been kind of it's been forgotten and ignored because of the events from Tunisia to Egypt. But the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, in southern Lebanon, it was created back in 1978. And we saw back in 2006, 2007, I believe, the Israeli incursion to tamp down Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And when the Israeli forces withdrew, France and Italy especially put into five figures of troops to augment that. And what we've seen in the interim is what the Israelis were worried about and pretty much knew it was going to happen anyway. We saw a rearming, a reinvigoration of Hezbollah to the point that the Lebanese government right now has, for all intents and purposes, taken power in Lebanon. You know, when you're talking about these structures that we have nationally that were built for World War II, there's also an international construct, the poster child being the United Nations, but you can also see the same infection in NATO and especially the EU military forces, where there's a lot of talk and a lot of perceived action, but what it actually seems to do is to promote and enable those that have an aggressive mindset because they don't play by these Marquis of Queensbury rules. Do you also see a need on the international front that we need to reassess how we do things that we don't actually wind up making them worse in the long run?
Well, there's a couple points to that. The part of the American problem with not being able to think or allocate resources to long-term goals like this that we're talking about, the challenge there, if everything the U.S. is doing and investing its time and effort in is sort of this immediate goal, you know, we need support for the invasion of Iraq. We need support for the sanction regime against Iran. Always going to a place like the U.N., having these conversations, pushing for these things that you need. Are you ever really getting do you have any bandwidth left over? Do you have anybody actually saying, you know, this is what we want to craft in the long run? And yes, there's strategies written there. Everybody has these documents that sort of are providing this guiding sort of principle. But has anybody read them? And are we making any meaningful progress towards reshaping our national institutions, for example, to be more agile, to be more responsive? You know, one of the founding ideas of our republic is, you know, no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, only permanent interests. We've seen some international entities become less useful over time, either because they're just too unwieldy or because, I mean, look at NATO right now. There's at least three different factions of countries in NATO that don't really agree on anything anymore because there's no clear ever-present threat to really galvanize everybody's thinking and get them to spend the money they need to spend on defense in the ways that the alliance needs it to be spent. And so there's an existential crisis for NATO right now. And if the U.S. can't be thinking in a coherent can't be thinking and acting on that thinking in a really structured way, you can't really have a good perspective on a good perspective on where do you need to be focusing your effort. You know, what sort of institution should we be crafting? Who are our most important allies? Not based on who our most important allies always have been, but who are going to be the critical allies in the years ahead?
Well, from our chat room, somebody has asked a pretty good question, which is, as you look forward, what's the worst case scenario with respect to Egypt? What's your point of view on what would happen if Egypt became another one of the Islamic republics?
Right.
Or what would?
Well, I mean, one of the ways in which the U.S. Manages the Middle East is through a series of balances of power. There's the Indo-Pakistani balance of power. the Iranian-Iraqi balance of power and the Arab-Israeli balance of power. From a balance of power perspective, a stronger, more aggressive Egypt might have some value. But you've got that real challenge in that it's not just the security of Israel that's at stake with this. There's, I saw somebody else in the chat room mentioned Suez. You know, Suez is right there. Now, again, if we're as deeply embroiled in this region as we are, that's a pretty huge problem for the United States. It's a much bigger problem for Israel. Israel has taken the current status of Egypt, strength of the regime, the lack of a military threat to their south, as pretty much the permanent way of things. And it's had problems with Hezbollah, it's had problems with Hamas. The Egyptian military, even though you see a lot of U.S. tanks on the streets of Cairo right now, is not what it was in 73 or 67. But it still is going to require Israel to fundamentally rethink its security policies. But there's a lot of ways this can go down. It doesn't necessarily strike me as having to be sort of the Hamas-Gaza scenario. It's not clear that the regime, and again, the regime, not Mubarak, cannot continue to control things and can't move forward in a way where you get more or less an Egypt honoring the policies, the treaties of Egypt in the years ahead. You've also got the problem of the opposition being so divided and in some cases the leaderless. But it's a real concern. And I don't know if anybody has I would say the worst case is that we're now in a position where we're looking at we're really seriously looking at the possibility of that. Again, we're not really seeing that yet. Sign that the Muslim Brotherhood itself is not even necessarily as bad as it might be. There's a lot of different factions in the Brotherhood. It's not necessarily coherent. There's not necessarily a lot of leadership there. So even if a large the Muslim Brotherhood won significant representation, it wouldn't necessarily lead to the Hamas and Gaza example.
I know. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. Oh, well, actually, that was my last point. Was just going to be, again, if we're looking at Egypt as an ally, as an important ally, we need to be focused on. And we see that in this ally, we have a population that's being repressed, and things aren't necessarily being done in a sustained way, a sustainable way. And you've got Mubarak, who's just refusing, like holding on to power tenaciously, trying to put his son into power. If we're so busy with Iraq and Afghanistan that as long as Egypt is fine now, we'll deal with any long-term instability issues there somewhere down the road, then this sort of thing happens. We can't prevent everything, even if we had a more balanced perspective. But have we really – has our Egypt policy really been what it should have been for the last 30 years, especially in recent years? Or did we sort of give Mubarak a pass? And now, instead of a slow transition that we encourage, we've got a crisis on our hands. That's the only question I'd raise.
When you were talking earlier about looking at long-term trends, the thing that I find the most fascinating is what most people really aren't talking about right now, because I think we're really – we're down in the weeds here doing play by play with, you know, does very short term, does Mubarak stay or does he go? You know, what are these immediate implications? I think what's really interesting and kind of ties into to one of your comments a minute ago about, you know, can we really control things? I think we also need to be very humble and realize that we don't control the world. The world and history and peoples oftentimes will pick their own path regardless of what we want. But when you look at the Arab world and what's going on right now, and a couple of commenters have made a point that I think is probably accurate, is that we're at the beginning of something new here. We don't know really what's going to come out the other end. But it's not something that you're really going to see in a year, or maybe 5 to 10. And it's these two things. The Tunisia problem, I think you can separate from what's going on for two things that are two of my favorite hobby horses that always bore people to death, demographics and economics. Tunisia, they are even below replacement rate. They're almost European in the amount of children. They're below 2.1. I think they're at 1.7. But when you go over to Egypt and especially Yemen, you have this huge demographic bow wave that's coming. They have a very high birth rate. They have very poor economies. They have very inflexible economies. So you have this huge bow wave of young people who are coming online that are going to exist in a country and economy which cannot sustain them. I think the figure was the vast majority of Egyptians live on $2 a day. Yemen are even worse. They're still having tons of children. In Egypt, the only power base that really exists besides the present administration and the military is the Muslim Brotherhood. And in Yemen, if you take away the people ruling party now, you have tribalism, cat, and fundamentalist Islam. You also seen what's going on in Jordan, though I think Jordan and Syria are different because of their cultures. I think there's also something in the background that within living memory, the kingdom of Jordan and the Assad family have been more than willing to kill thousands of people at any one time. You know, the Black September in Jordan, and of course the uprising in Syria where they effectively leveled entire villages and poured concrete on them. But looking in the long term, the demographics and the economic problem in Egypt and Yemen, I really see creating instability in 5 and 10 years. And when you consider they sit athwart some of the most important sea lines of communications, we're not going to land troops and try to affect local conditions there, especially with what we've seen in the last decade. I think the American public's had enough of that. What can we do 10, 15 years down the road with this demographic and economic nightmare to mitigate the impact it has on our allies and our trading partner, China even, ability to have a sustainable global economic system as these critical parts of the world just implode on themselves?
Mm-hmm. No, it's a really great point. You've got... Well, one point that sort of came up, in a blank answer to your question. These guys, and we're talking about transnational terrorism, extremism, sort of the Al-Qaeda franchise shops. These guys think about two struggles. They think about the physical struggle and the ideological struggle. And as long as you have the ideological struggle, you'll be dealing with the physical struggle in some manifestation. Even if it's this more lone wolf grassroots stuff that we're talking about now, and you're right, we cannot. These guys have to come to their own conclusion. We can't make them decide that economic development and that sort of thing is in their own interest. They have to believe it. And I think that's the real question is you know, we've seen, I forget the guy's name, but this is where Saudi and Egypt have been, you know, another place they've been important allies, is they've taken some of these guys that they've captured and really put them through some re-education programs. And some of the guys they captured, they can turn around and they're actually be a voice that opposes something like jihad in the way it's being practiced by groups like Al-Qaeda. And I think that's sort of the one, the ideology part of this is key. There's economic troubles there. There's real fundamental economic problems. I think you're exactly right, because these places are growing far out of proportion of their economic livelihood, their base, to support that population in any sort of economically viable way. But the real trick here is you're never going to stamp out Islamism and some of the other ideologies that we're really struggling with, but all of this fighting we're doing in Iraq and Afghanistan isn't making us any friends in the world right now in terms of this ideology. Now, we've got to go do what we've got to go do, but at the end of the day, what we really want to be doing is doing what we can to minimize the cause of not just the global, the transnational terrorism problem, but this idea that we're the bad guy. And this sort of extremist ideology, if these places can start to want to play by these rules, because as we saw with Ataturk, what we're seeing with the AKP in Turkey right now is really interesting in that Islam does not necessarily, even these Islamist leaning groups that get into politics, they don't have to be, it doesn't have to be Gaza and Hamas. It doesn't have to be Iran. And if we can get that, making sure it's more of a Turkey model than it is an Iran or Gaza issue, where you've got that more hardline, incompatibility ideologically, I think we're going to be in a stronger position to deal with the economic issues that you're raising, demographic issues, because once you get there, then you can start doing things like economic development. You can have young kids who you can move over to the India model, where you might not always be in the best place geographically for resources, but if you can get that development going, you can start to integrate with the global economy. And so that's, one of the reasons that it might not, if you can get rid of the ideology problem, it might not be that unmanageable in a world of global trade, in a world of telecommuting, in a world of, being able to move around so relatively easily.
If we move from the Middle East and Egypt and look at some of the situations arising in our own hemisphere with Mexico and Venezuela, they're not Muslim states, but they also have, or at least Mexico has, a large population and great wealth, which is not distributed very evenly throughout the course. How great is the risk of Mexico becoming a major problem to us, and are you aware of any long-range strategic plan about what to do about it?
Well, the real problem in Mexico is its drug trade. And as long as we have the drug laws we have in this country, we're going to have the problem in Mexico. Now, it wasn't always Mexico, but we got pretty good about enforcing things, interdicting drug flows by air and by sea. Especially in the Pacific side. So the problem moved. It moved to the land, and it moved to the easiest way to get stuff into the country, which is across this really long border we have with Mexico. Mexico is engaged in a counter-drug campaign against the cartels, but the real problem is that we're talking tens of billions of dollars that are in the Mexican economy every year. It's black and gray on the drug trade side, but that flows back into the economy. There's a real challenge in that when you start talking about an inflow of tens of billions of dollars annually, you're talking about something that systematically Mexico can't just. The problem is not just that Mexico, wasn't doing this. When there's that much money in the black and gray economies, you have a lot of trouble with, corruption, with sort of the drug cartels just being an enormous economic. I mean, look at the Chicago Prohibition era example. We've all seen The Untouchables. We all know the history there. The way that got solved was you repealed prohibition. People weren't going to stop drinking in Chicago, or in the United States, and that was where it was coming in. So the drug laws that are not something that's probably politically viable to change in this country, whatever you think about the morality of them, is going to mean that this is going to have to last. Now, so the question is finding a way to manage it. When you go around trying to stop it with the idea that you're going to be able to stop it, you can make the problem worse. And that, I think that's the question with what's going on in Mexico right now, is not that we should give – I'm not advocating that we give drug runners a free pass or anything like that. But what I am saying is, Mexico went in and cracked down and it stirred up a lot of hornet's nests. It's not something that I think we see becoming that necessarily needs to go down further downhill and needs to get out of hand. But it does need to get back to some sort of equilibrium as it was before this big crackdown.
I think what's kind of interesting, because it's kind of from the be careful what you ask for school, is one of my favorite countries in Latin America is Colombia. And it's not just because, in my humble opinion, they have the best-looking women in South America. When we were kids, it was the huge drug problem in Colombia. And Colombia had a lot of success in breaking the back of the cartels, breaking the back of their narco-terrorists. Yeah, it's still there, but they made great success. And I think what we saw is that balloon was squeezed in Colombia. You saw it inflate in Mexico and become a greater problem with Mexico. They had to do exactly what you said. They had to crack down, but they cracked down when the drug cartels had gotten strong, and we have a little mini narco war going on in northern Mexico. And one thing that's got my noggin puzzling is the fact that the demand signal is, as you described, right, it's coming from the United States. And even if tomorrow we passed a Dutch-style drug law in the Netherlands, you still can't get cocaine, you still can't get heroin, they still crack down on them. Matter of fact, you used to be able to get mushrooms there, but they're getting rid of that too. So a demand signal, assume you can't do anything with that in the U.S. because we're too rich and too lazy and we like our drugs. But if Mexico was able to squeeze that, that demand signal is going to push on somebody else. What are the next weak countries that are going to have that same exact problem in that we saw in Colombia? We're now seeing in Mexico, because that money is going to corrupt. I don't think it's going to be Canada, though they have a little bit of a drug problem there. But look at the other Central American states. Will it be Venezuela? Because that's another oil-rich country that's a complete basket case, that maybe that's where the problem would go next. So just as kind of a thought, say Mexico did win their drug war, where is that war now going to transfer? Colombia, Mexico, then where next?
Yeah. Well, you've got two things here. You've got the production and you've got the transit issue. Mexico, I think, by virtue of its long border. I mean, unless you can't move some of this growth issue north, but you can, you know, there's all sorts of ways to move drugs around. I mean, you've got these guys building these semi-submersibles, and honestly, now I think they've even got a fully submersible drug boat or design that they work with. But the thing that actually, when you brought up Colombia, that reminded me, it was the Plan Colombia. You know, how we helped support Colombia in solving that problem. Because, you know, the FARC wasn't just, you know, they're pretty much thugs and drug hunters now, but they used to be an ideological movement. And, you know, we've gotten, seen it get knocked back, not just geographically, but to the point where they don't really have the ideological ground to stand on that they once did. And, you know, they're pretty much criminals and thugs at this point in terms of, you know, kidnapping for money, drug running for money, just to sustain themselves. They don't really have any extra bandwidth to pursue whatever semblance of an ideological goal they might have left over. But there's something else there too, in that long-term sustained cooperation and assistance at a lower level. You know, now Colombia has probably hands down the best trained infantry in Latin America. That's something we can be thinking about, not just in our hemisphere, but inside of the world. I mean, look at how we've managed al-Qaeda in Yemen compared to how we've managed al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. This sort of cooperative, some financing, some training, probably some guys with guns that don't exist and armed drones. But it's a much more long-range policy to improve a country's own ability to manage its internal problems. It's getting a little off topic, but I think that's really something to be thinking about, is if you have this long-range perspective and this long-range idea, and you can sustain policies across administrations over time, you can really craft things for the better. Not just for our national interests or, you know, for a particular policy, but really help shape things. And I think that goes back to your question about demographics in the long run in Egypt and Yemen, and it's also about how we conduct ourselves, not just militarily, but in this management of, you know, transnational terrorism, is if we go kick in the door, in Afghanistan, we had to do that. Not we shouldn't have, but let the problem fester. Don't really deal with the problem. Then the only way to fix it is to send in 100,000 troops, and suddenly we want results right now. We feel like if we've committed 100,000 troops to this, then we should be able to get results quickly, which is not really at all how counterinsurgency works. And that's the thing. If you're being forward thinking about this, you can really manage it a lot better with a lot less resources than if you go kicking the door and dealing with things that have gotten out of hand.
Well, there's some discussion in the chat room about the sovereign rights that countries need to assert every now and then. And I think one of the issues is we've got some cover from the Canadians on our northern border. In fact, great cover for Canadians on our northern border. But we're not doing much on our southern border to protect ourselves protect our own sovereign rights. And I guess the question that was asking earlier involving Mexico and Venezuela is we're seeing some chinks being taken out of the Monroe Doctrine and our historic efforts to keep foreign enterprise, foreign countries out of the Western Hemisphere and interfering in the Western Hemisphere. Where are we going to go with that? What is the future of our sovereign rights as concerning Mexico and the nations to our east, south, and west.
Right. Well, a couple of thoughts. I mean, on the Chavez issue in Venezuela, I'm really just waiting for that guy to get shot by an AK that he had built in his country. I think his regime has some real challenges, and how that plays out and what comes next, I think, is a real interesting question that we don't. And again, it's once you get to that point where you've got this, you know, firebrand sort of running the show, it becomes harder to shape things. But I would say that having such a strong ally in Colombia next door makes that problem more manageable. You know, and there's an interesting thing to go back to the policy side of this. We've got a couple different legal policy things that we don't really have our house in order on. Immigration is another one. The United States is in an extraordinarily strong position as our population ages compared to Japan and Europeans because we integrate immigrants so much better. So in the long run, we'll be able to attract immigrants from abroad, attract talent, and integrate immigrants and continue to grow as a country that we always have. But our house isn't in order in terms of our immigration policy, and that just makes the Mexico problem more difficult. Ultimately, you've got this inherently cross-border phenomenon, which is the drug trade, which is the illegal immigration. And if as long as those exist, you're going to have challenges. I think it's important just to make sure that you've got good coordination and you're crafting good policy in terms of working to improve the Mexican government's ability to enforce its own laws and its own writ in its territory. So when you have a problem, you can call them and have them fix it rather than having to start, you know, the situation we have in Pakistan where we are pretty much constantly violating Pakistan's sovereignty. And that's the only other thing I would go to the Pakistan example on the sovereignty thing real quickly because what you want is a strong state that can work with you to coordinate on that sort of cross-border stuff. In Pakistan, what we're ultimately doing is our long-term national interest is in a strong Pakistan with a secure nuclear arsenal that can also help us to balance India and the rise of India there. And that's just sort of grand strategy, balance of power sort of stuff. But what we're doing right now, every time we're dropping ordnance in Pakistan, we're doing so much that's weakening Pakistan because of our operational demands in Afghanistan. And so when you talk about Mexico, when you talk about Pakistan, the parallel I'm drawing there is, you know, we don't have good policies, and that makes working towards solutions and managing problems that you can't solve more difficult.
What I would like to throw at you here, just completely changing the subject, bringing something close and personal. A couple weeks ago, you and I had a chance to sit down at a table with Undersecretary of the Navy Bob Work. And after he got through not answering my question about what are the good, the bad, and the ugly that we've learned in programs, you asked him a question that you talked on just briefly earlier on in today's episode about whether the Navy has a strategy. And I think that's a real important question because it was obliquely related to mine because to have a good strategy going forward, you have to be able to appraise the results of decisions you've made in the recent past to make sure that your thought process is going correctly. If you could please just briefly outline for the listeners what your question was and what the impression was you got from his answer.
Right. Well, I basically quoted Dr. Friedman spoke at the Naval Energy Forum in D.C. last year, and he opened his remarks by saying that the Navy had a budget, not a strategy. And that part of the reason that came back to me was because it really resonated with all of our talks at West 2011 about shipbuilding, about what we could afford. And he had a very good answer, very solid answer about sort of the how the Navy is thinking about, you know, modernization, its capabilities versus its competitors, and that sort of thing. But the thing he didn't really get to was, part of my question was, in this era of fiscal austerity and the potential for even more budget cuts, what's sort of guiding our choices? And he didn't really get to that. And I think we keep talking about these different aspects of not having a strategy. I mean, I know we have the Maritime Strategy for the 21st Century and all this stuff, and I'm sure a lot of people have read it. But strategy allows you to make choices and make priorities. And what I didn't hear from him and what I was hoping to hear was which capabilities, which mission areas, which competitors were they thinking about most closely? And if you have to start cutting a system, not asking, okay, well, how many of these can I afford, but which system do I need? And if I have to choose between two, what's guiding my choice? We get these, you know, 15-year programs, weapons programs that take on a life of their own. And so it's no longer a question of, I mean, I don't want to touch the LCS thing with the 10-foot pole after the debate that's been going on at the USNI blog recently. But, you know, that capability, that program is now the priority. They've decided to fund it, and they're pushing it forward, and they want all the capabilities it provides. But I heard no answer that would let me know, okay, well, you know, do we want to think about going back to our traditional reliance on allies for mine countermeasures work? Which, you know, if, for example, just use this, if we couldn't afford all the mission modules for the LCS, which one would we want to get rid of if we had to? And that's, I think, the real problem that penetrates all of the different aspects of the strategy question is if you don't have not only a clear, concise, unambiguous statement of strategy that everybody can refer to, but if you don't have a system where it's read and adhered to systematically, then no one really has guidance or makes choices with long-term strategy in mind. They deal with the problem in front of them, and dealing with the problem in front of you, whether it's, you know, how am I going to make budget work this year, even though my 30-year shipbuilding budget has been a mess for a long time, how am I going to make the budget work this year? And so maybe that means I get four of these ships and not seven. Or I'm sorry, three, not seven, as the case with the DG-1000. Not really asking, like, what is our position on Force Entry? Do we want that capability anymore? And so I think that's a real challenge is when you have these long-term weapons programs that sort of take on a life of their own. I mean, you know, look at the Joint Strike Fighter right now. Everything we're doing is basically a one fighter that's been compromised for everybody, so that everybody gets what they want. Nobody can seem to afford it, and it makes them compromises in every place. But bottom line, we've got a fighter that was conceived of all the requirements originally conceived. Well, about seven programs that were rolled into one for a war in Europe. When everything we're realistically thinking about high end capability for now, we're talking about you know, Middle East, where we may have some basing troubles, or the Pacific, and the Pacific is just friggin' huge, which is why. Sorry, I'm rambling a little bit. The one point I want to make, though, is with range in the Pacific. The reason I sort of rambled about the Joint Strike Fighter a little bit is because Australia just had to give up the F-111. They kept them as long as they could, But it was, they didn't have anything they could replace it with. Because nobody's, even though we're all looking strategically at, you know, in the long term about, you know, our military ability, our military options in the Pacific, no one's even, it's just going to be 2018 before we even have a, you know, flying prototype of a long range bomber, and nobody has a theater bomber like the F-111 in the works.
Well, Nate, we've kind of run out of time. If people wanted to read more of what you have to offer, where is a good place for them to go to find that?
Well, right now, Stratfor.com is our main site. We've got some footage covers, a lot of Egypt right now. And then I'm writing over at the USNI blog, blog.usni.org, and keep an eye out for NQs.
Well, great. Nate, thanks for taking time on Super Bowl Sunday to come talk with us today. I really appreciate your time.
I had a lot of fun, Sal. Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me, Eagle One.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Nate. Appreciate it.
And everybody, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day and come back and see us next Sunday. We're going to be live again. Our topic area is going to be on Russia, and our guest is going to be Dr. Dmitry Gorenberg of Harvard University. He's a senior analyst, CNA Strategic Studies Center Associate at the Davis Center. Take care.
Farewell, let us swear. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.